Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recoveryplan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Sam. Delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. You were in my an-hour seminar a couple of weeks ago, and we will debrief on that. And I want to hear about your job search. But before we do that, Sam, how about you just introduce yourself to our listeners?
My name is Sam Provenzano, and I live in Chicago. And I've been in the development field for about 11 years now.
So, Sam, I really like talking to guys and gals who are about 10 years into their fundraising careers, because I think they start, I think the 10-year mark, sort of beyond where you can get the credentialing and you've been to enough fundraising 101 seminars and stuff, but you're starting to think more critically about the work that you do. Would you say that's where you're at?
Absolutely. I think you really start to know what you really want to do in your career, and it's really a great time to kind of reassess where you're going to go in this wonderful philanthropic journey on this side of things.
So you were in that seminar with us, and we did 4 weeks of what we call our four frameworks here at Responsive. So what's your thoughts on that? Did anything rattle your cage or give you some major pushback, or what'd you think?
You know, I really enjoyed it. It was so nice to know that there's such a group of people, you know, that have the similar beliefs and values that you have, and really bringing that, you know, humanistic view to philanthropy. And that's what I was so excited about. Like, these are my people, you know, and I just didn't know about you guys and about you. And I'm so glad I was, you know, introduced. And I think I saw something on something with Jim Langley. And that's how kind of I learned about responsive fundraising. And then from there, it was just it was just great. And in the waves and the way that you talked about that, and you really make a lot of things just make more sense. And then when we do go and work with some of these directors of development or vice presidents, whatever you want to call, at least they can know kind of where we are at. What was the KPI that kind of, is that what you had? Is that what that was?
Yeah, the KPI card is designed, Sam, to, as I was telling you before we hit the record button, I'm really trying to advocate for the fundraiser, whereas a lot of folks, I think, in my space are trying to advocate for the association or for the board or for the perhaps the nonprofit in general. I really think we need to think more about how we create I'm a baseball guy. So how do we create baseball parks where guys like you can play some really good baseball? And and that KPI card is all focused on input. So if you remember, all the variables that you can put on that card were metrics that you can be accountable for. And the one metric that wasn't on there actually, what is the dollar sign? You can't ultimately, one of the things I think we need to really get our heads wrapped around in fundraising is ultimately you cannot control whether or not your donor writes a check, and but you can ensure that you're doing everything all the way up to that point. That's what that KPI card does.
Yeah, I thought it was just so unique and fresh and today and tomorrow. You know what I mean? It's just, it's all those things that I think fundraisers like myself need, especially those in that, you know, that 10-year mark. We're looking for that next thing to keep us going, you know, to keep us motivated and to really bring back that joy that we had in our first job. You know, that's still out there for me. I want to find that again, you know?
So you shared with me, I think offline, that you're in the middle of a job search and COVID-19 probably isn't making it particularly easy. So what's your experience thus far? And let's talk about maybe for the benefit of any of our listeners who are looking for a good major gifts guy, maybe they can hear our conversation and say, hey, I'm going to reach out to that guy, Sam, and start a conversation. So tell us about yourself and what your careers look like thus far.
Sure. You know, my career, I was a news anchor and reporter out of Kentucky, Bowling Green, right out of college. I wanted to be the next Matt Lauer, but not anymore. I wanted to, I really wanted to be that next it thing, right? The next big guy. And I liked it and I was very good at it, but I was warned in one of my classes at Indiana University to make sure you go into journalism for the right reasons. Just don't go on there to be on television. And of course, you know, I said, well, I do love it. I do love it. But when you're working 16 hours a day for $16,000 your first year out of college, you know, it's a lot, you know, it's just a lot to deal with. And I didn't love it. And if you don't love it, you're not going to want to do the work. You're not going to really embrace it. And I interviewed a child. His name was Robert Cunningham from St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Because I was filming one of his stories. He was coming back home from treatment. And I ended up being really close to the family and covered his passing as well. He ended up passing away from cancer. And that's how I learned about St. Jude. And I said to myself, this is what I want to do. I have the gift of gab, but I have a lot to learn. So I took a job actually with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital, which was a really cool story. And, started as an event marketing representative in Albany, New York. And that was really how I got started in my career. So that was really exciting. And then, you know, obviously after I started with LSAC St. Jude, I ended up moving back to Chicago and took a job with the Alzheimer's Association and really started working with, you know, major gifts and major donors because I really loved that aspect. But I really had to learn it from the ground up because when you're doing events, it's very different than working with donors. And my passion was finding the why, because when I was a reporter, I was really good. I had to use like my ability to make people trust me and the ability to talk to just about anyone and building relationships within the community. So I tried to utilize all those tools I had as a reporter and bring them to philanthropy. And that's kind of how I've kind of done that. I know it's kind of a long answer. It's a bad answer for me.
No, that's great. So Sam, I don't think I've ever, a lot of
we
us
don't know each other well, so I don't,
We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. So I don't think I've ever talked to someone who started in journalism and went into, and I'm sure there's plenty of people out there, but I'm trying to sort of connect the dots between a person who, because I can totally see how a person who likes to understand the story. I think we like to say that we as fundraisers, one of the things I get tired of is there's a lot of storytelling talk in the fundraising space and I don't, and it's oftentimes oriented towards us telling the story and it's like, we have to be great storytellers. And in some ways I think, and this is, I think if I'm connecting the dots in sort of your narrative, the, what you're sharing with me is that you're trying to get the story out of the donor or the person you're interviewing or like this young man, you know, this tragic story that you sort of compelled you into the space. And I think that's what really meaningful, really significant fundraising looks like, is that you've got to really begin. You got to begin with the question of like, why, and why does it matter to you? And you're basically asking open-ended. Open-ended questions. Right. Yeah.
And as a child, would go back and as a child, I would ask my mom, and like, and she would always ask why, and not like every other kid. It was really, I've always was curious, and that curiosity is what led me into this world of fundraising. And I had no idea it would lead to, 10 years in the field and having a good grasp of major gift fundraising, but totally learning more every day.
Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot. This is a test. So tell us about one of those. Tell us about one of those interactions. Tell us about one of those. I have in my career, both in my, as an employee, but also as a consultant, I have sat across the lunch table from a major donor probably, 1,000 times. Tell us about one that sort of really, tell us about one of those experiences that you've had that really just sort of brings you, sort of pulls your story together and makes everything sort of come to light.
Yeah. For me, I like to go on my tenacity and my ability to kind of just be authentic in myself. And there was this donor, that great donor on paper, right? Great capacity, but capacity doesn't mean anything until you really meet with that donor. Right. I got to meet with this gentleman in Arizona. I realized he had the capacity. He was saying the right things, but he just, was kind of playing the field a little bit, just kind of balking and playing some hardball. And that was fine with
me.
And, he was telling about his recent, he did a $2 million gift at X, Y, and Z. But he wasn't ready yet because he wanted to learn more about, blah, 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 blah. Well, one of the most, I think, inspiring things that happened to me was, it was towards the end of our, maybe 12 or 13 months into our relationship. And I brought him back on to campus where I worked at DePaul University. I don't know if I can say that. It's fine. I was at DePaul University. I brought him back on campus and he was bringing his daughter. She was going to tour the law school while at the same time I was going to take the father around and show him the law school that he was going to. It was so different than the law school that his daughter was about to go into. So that was really cool to see and walk with his daughter because I've developed a relationship with the family. So you have Sam and then this 2 feet pupil. And the dean walks by and I'm introducing the dean to him and he goes to her. He's like, "This guy's a Chihuahua." And I'm like, "What? I'm not." He's like, he just kept going and he didn't give up on me. And, and I think he just appreciated that. And I think that's like such a misconception in our industry, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but because you know more. But I think the major donors, the most loyal prospects, the most loyal donors appreciate our hustle. They appreciate that you're trying to get a hold of them. You're going on LinkedIn. You're calling me at different times. You're changing up your message. It was all a test. And at that very end,
I call it tension. I think getting the tension, I've been working with a client out west for, I don't know, 6 months now. And I remember the last time I was on site and we had a meeting. So it was two employees and a major donor couple, and which was kind of a crowded room. I'm not a big fan of having that many people in the room, but nonetheless, I deliberately made sure that there was tension in the room. Because I didn't get a sense from the beginning of the conversation that this conversation was going to go anywhere if we didn't sort of get everybody invested in the, essentially in the conversation. We had to sort of pull this guy and his wife into the conversation and so we used tension. I used tension and I think it worked for the donor and his wife, but my client, I think, was uncomfortable. One of the two individuals. But I think you're right. I'd say probably a good number of my experiences, Sam, have involved that tension, that deliberate, and this, I mean, we talk about this all the time in fundraising, that first gift and perhaps even that first meeting is oftentimes a test. It's is this guy going to take me seriously enough? Is he somebody that I want to take serious enough?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here's a great story. And you know, I, for some reason, you know, it's been, this is so cool to have this opportunity. So I'm a little like, oh my goodness, you know, a little intimidated by your knowledge, my friend.
Sure.
But it's here's, fine. Here's a great story. Here's a great story that maybe is a little better. And I think I put it on my LinkedIn recently. So there was a donor that, you know, he was giving quite a bit of, and a couple thousand dollars per year and getting the typical treatment, but no one was really going out and visiting him. He's very hard to reach. I don't think it was intentional. Sure. You know, you're trying and then, you know how it goes. They go from portfolio to portfolio, unfortunately. And then, you know, this one lands on my doorstep. So I go and I try to do my thing. And I asked him a question. I think I asked him about, because he had a plane, he had a nice home, and I'm just talking about like the cool stuff. He had all the cool stuff, but he's not giving to us. Why? So there's my reporter thing going in. I'm doing research. I'm finding out. So then I asked one of my power questions, and I asked him, what is it? You know, do you have any unfinished business, or, you know, you've done so much in your career. What is it that you haven't done? Like, is there something that you haven't done, like unfinished business? And he looked at me like, literally, this is one of those stupid books that you read and you don't believe that the story happened. But this is coming from Sam, and I swear to God, I have nothing to lose here. And he looks at me and he's like, you know what? My parents really wanted me to, you know, start my own business. And I did all that, but I really wanted to play the saxophone. I was really good. And I really wanted to have a career in saxophone. And they kind of took that dream away from me. I never, you know, it's, and he opened up to me and it was just like this crazy moment. And then he's like, and that made him stop and think about our, you know, the music center and maybe doing a scholarship in that, in honor of a student wanting to do music, whatever it is. But that's where our that's where it all started. And it took three or four years, but we just didn't ask him the right question.
Yeah. And you had to be bold and you had to put that sort of tension in the room and sort of step out on this, sort of step up to the edge, step up to the plate and sort of risk the chance. Step up to the plate,
but it's always authentic, in an authentic way, with my humor, with my, you know, I'm not going to change who I am. I've tried the whole come in a suit, got all my stuff ready to go to talk about. That's not philanthropy to me anymore. That was me 10 years ago. You know, 8 years ago, five years ago.
Okay.
You know?
Okay. So let's talk about so one of the things, Sam, that I have always sort of thought, so sort of reflecting on that interaction that you had there with that donor, did that donor know, that donor knew you were a fundraiser and they knew the role you were in. Am I right?
He sure did.
Yeah. And so the do you think some of the we'll call it vulnerability. Do you think that some of the vulnerability that because soliciting funds and the exchange of a gift was perhaps part of the conversation actually is what sort of made him receptive to sort of having that more meaningful conversation? I mean, it sounds like it wasn't just a transaction. You guys could have kept it shallow.
Sure.
And you could have just sort of exchanged a gift, but instead, because you sort of pushed the envelope a little bit, mm-hmm. asked a bold question, you sort of took the relationship to another level. And sometimes I wonder if it's actually because of the nature of the relationship that is somewhat of an awkward, it's not a defined relationship. I think that's one of the challenges we have in this industry is that the relationship between a donor and an organization or between a fundraiser and a donor is not something that we as a society have sort of figured out. We know how to be in relationship with our spouses and our significant others. We know how to be in relationship with our children. Mm-hmm. I know how to be in relationship with my dog. But we don't know how to be in relationship between, you know, fundraisers and donors. And so we're still trying to, at a macro level, figure out the way these relationships work. Do you think that was sort of what was playing out there?
Absolutely. And I was, and this is just the truth. I was planting that seed for 8 months. You know, I saw the potential. I took him out. We went to a Phoenix Suns game. We went to different things, you know, leading up to having these conversations. So it really wasn't, it was really that snowball effect of being vulnerable, showing a little bit of who I am through these 12 months through different ways of, and we can talk all day on that, right? You know, but there's a way of approaching a donor that's just, this is Sam, and I, they can read you. If they sense that you're only there to, you know, get my money and then I'll see you next year or whatever, if you're not going to be able to separate yourself from, you know, the pack, then it's really going to be difficult. So I really think there is a sense of vulnerability and authenticity that people have looked at me like I was crazy, like I'm opening up too much. And that has really, you know, that had hurt my career early on because I was having success, but I was told not to do certain things or act a certain way. And that's a reality. And I can say that right now because I don't really have a job.
Okay. So did you enjoy, so think about that Suns game that you and this gentleman went to.
Sure.
Were you a sales guy or like, what's your posture? One of the things I have figured out is that a really good fundraiser knows how to sit in that seat next to the donor and really enjoy being there and not feel like they're a sales guy. Not feel like they've got to sort of drive the conversation and they've got to really enjoy being there. And they've got to enjoy the game. They got to enjoy being there differently than perhaps you and I. You know, if you and I went to a basketball game, bought beers and stuff, you know, as buds, I guess.
Sure.
It is certainly a different dynamic. But I think, and this is for my listeners, if you're interviewing a candidate like Sam, how do you convey to me, a prospective employer, that you enjoy being there at that Suns game with that guy?
You know, that's what I missed that last question, that last part of it. It cut out.
Yeah. How do you convey what I'm saying to our listeners is the idea that how does a guy like Sam, how do you convey to us that you enjoy being there differently than say being there with your college buddies?
Oh, sure. You know, it's really, it's listening and watching them. It's really about them. It's not about us. And that's coming from a former news reporter. It's not about me. And that's something I had to learn very quickly, very quickly.
Wow. Unpack that for me. I've never heard that. That's good.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, in news reporting, it's very quick fix. I know how I did the next minute. It's a very quick fix. What do they call it? It's almost as if my results are right after my my work. I get to know how I'm doing, and I get criticism right away. I know if I did good. I know if I did bad. I know if it's time to move on to the next thing. In fundraising, it's a process. You know, it's going to take time. You're not going to see the fruits of your labor the next day on tape, boo. You're not. And and that's just not it. And it's not about me. Yes, it's great to have charisma. It's great to have the ability to speak and have gab. But if you can't listen, then you're never going to be successful. And that was,
That's pretty insightful. That's the notion of, it's couplings. Basically, it's the coupling between any two sort of activities. It's like education. We all believe in education, but education, K through 12 education, for example, takes 13 years. And we as a society have developed an appreciation that, you know, we know that child's going to go from kindergarten to first grade to second, you know, and so forth. But we know that the distance between each one of those sort of those indicators of success ultimately is not going to sort of play out to in its fullest until that child graduates from, say, high school. And so that's awesome. Kind of what you're talking about. That's what you're talking about playing out at that basketball game.
Sure.
Did he enjoy being there as you were like, did he know he was a donor or did he know that, or we see a college buddy drinking a beer at a basketball game with, you know, a college.
You know, I think there's time and place. There's moments in that game where we had a few sentences where it was like, oh, like because he was like, he's like, you know, I hope you appreciate the gift or whatever. He's like, but this is just the beginning. Now let's watch the game. He's like basically telling me, let's just have fun. You did your, you know, they look at us, we're human. They know we're looking, you know, they know we're fundraising. We have jobs to do. They have sales. They're trying to close deals. They know that this is a big deal to us. And I think they respect that. So there are moments in that during that game where we did talk a little bit about philanthropy. But my main priority is to build that relationship, the trust. And at the end of the day, you want to enjoy the game. You don't want to listen to Sam Provenzano speak. He gets plenty of that during our luncheons, you know, and our get-togethers. This was a time for us to bond about basketball or whatever it is you want to do. Go to, you know, take them somewhere where, you know, there's my some advice there. You know, take them somewhere we can just see them in their element. And then you never know when that story is going to unfold. And when that next,
why was it a, you know, why was it a basketball game? Why was it a basketball game?
Well, he chose it.
He did. Okay.
He did. He chose it. He actually treated me to this because we had worked, together so much. And I think it was almost like a celebration of, you know, kind of what we were doing together. A great celebration. I was very, you know, grateful for that. And then through that relationship, he also helped me open up to some other alums that he knew and other friends that would be maybe interested. So not only did he trust me, you know, with him, I think he then opened up his Rolodex to other people. And I think that's something I never really saw or felt until that moment. You know what I mean? You hear about it, but until you kind of feel it and you build the relationship and it's real and it's authentic, oh man, it's just like, you can't teach it. And that's, it's hard to explain. I think you understand.
I do. So Sam, you were telling me before we hit the record button that you're looking for an opportunity, perhaps in the Chicago area, Chicago metro area, or perhaps you'd be interested in going down to Austin. But what kind of organization are you actually looking to work for?
Sure. I'm looking to really, if you look at my resume, every place I have gone has had a reason. There's been a mission. There's been a story behind it. I don't just take a job to just take a job. That's just not who I am. And I think that's a lot of us in this field, you hope, right?
Yes.
But for me, it's about bringing in new ideas and new strategies for your major gift teams. If you're looking for a leader who does not lead by fear, who is a team player, who's collaborative, who brings fun to the workplace and closes gifts, you know, I'm your guy, you know, and that's just me talking as a friend. You know, I've learned so much in my career, and I've had those crazy up and down moments or losing a dream job. You know, those are really difficult things to go through, but they make you tougher. And, you know, just recently, you know, I was final two, right? I started posting on LinkedIn because of Jim Langley and yourself and other mentors. And I said, okay, I'm finally going to take the reins and separate myself and show what I got. The last 7 weeks when I didn't get that last, I was runner up. Remember, I just said to myself, okay, it's time to take it up a notch. So here I am now showing, you know, some strategies and tips on LinkedIn, you know, and it's really working. It's amazing. I can't believe I waited this long, but I was so scared and intimidated. I waited 3 years to post on LinkedIn. Now I would like and reshare, but it's scary when your mentors and people you adore in this industry, like yourself and Jim Langley and Teresa and my old bosses, you know, liking your stuff, resharing your stuff. That's not something I'm bragging about. That's something that means the world to me. Like
that's what
this is all about, man.
So let's talk about that for a minute. Let's just totally go off on a bunny trail for a minute.
Yeah, man.
I don't know if today's bosses, the people that like, I don't think I'm much older than you are. I don't think the bosses out there know how to employ that person. I don't think they're any more. I'm not convinced that the bosses know how to employ someone like yourself who's got the energy to sort of be present on social media, for example, without seeing it as perhaps without misinterpreting it. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, my way, this is my way to find a job. See, my way, this isn't me to be a coach. This is Sam's way of finding a job. See, I created an Instagram account as well, sharing tips.
Yeah, but are you going to stop So you've made a presence for yourself. The last, as a friend and a, perhaps a coach here, just self-appointed coach here for a few minutes.
Sure.
I would tell you that after you land your job, you're going to land a job. Most fundraising professionals land a job relatively quickly in any market. You're going to land a job, but I think you need to keep your presence. So you said you weren't present for the last several years. I think you need to keep your presence up. And so what I'm asking you is do you think you're likely to work for a boss who's okay with your presence on social media?
They'll hate it. They'll hate it.
Why?
But the right Why one will love it, and that's who I want. That's who I'm trying to draw in as well. You know what I'm saying? Because the right people aren't. It's in this time where we are, where the interviews are very hard to come by, even getting them, because positions just aren't around. Yes. You have to keep yourself engaged and motivated. I don't want people looking at my page and seeing that I've done nothing since I lost my job in January, you know, so I've been helping, you know, creating a development plan, helping other colleagues and being a vulnerable, something that you hear all about. And I thought I was until now. So again, this, all these dark moments that, you know, I'd love to really talk about one day to hopefully inspire. It's just to inspire and help people through their philanthropic journeys. Because these 10 years have been some exciting years and some really dark years. But I think every fundraiser.
I want to go back to all these interviews, all these conversations that I have here on the podcast are always sort of a learning experience for me. I want to go back to what you said earlier about being the skills, sort of the training that you got as a reporter, because I think there's something that I've experienced myself over and over again that's probably similar. I think you alluded to this when you were talking about that, when we were talking about the guy at the basketball game. You sort of have to be on your toes and you've got to keep the conversation going.
Boom.
And sometimes you almost have to risk putting your foot in your mouth, sort of asking the wrong question. I'm not talking about tension. I'm just saying you're sort of keeping the conversation alive until you arrive at sort of what we would call flow. Is that something that they teach in journalism to keep that interview going? It's kind of like the work that I do here on this podcast. I've got to sort of achieve, you know, the first couple of minutes of an interview doesn't really sort of achieve a certain level of flow. But once you get in there, it flows.
Yeah, you're so right. And I was a little nervous on this in this podcast, strangely being a reporter, but I was a little nervous. So I probably didn't explain it as well. So this is what my thing is about a reporter. So as a reporter, I got to build trust with that stranger on the street in about 35 seconds. They're looking at me with a microphone. They don't want anything to do with Sam, right? But you got to make that eye connection. You got to make that humor. You got to make that impact. Hey, if it's not for you, we're not going to get this story. You want this burglar caught? I need you to talk. You know, it's all about impact, right? So, and then when there's those bigger stories, Jason, like a murder, or if there's an accident, who are they going to call? You know, as a reporter, there's about six other reporters coming to the same exact sheriff, and they want that story. There's six of us there. I want them to go to Sam because I have built that relationship. I know their families. They know they can trust me. And 9 out of 10 times, they came to me because that's what it was. It wasn't anything special I did. I probably wasn't even as good of a writer as some of them. Hell, I'm not even in the industry anymore. You know, but I was myself. I really was. And some people liked it. Some people didn't, but the majority of it did. And that's when I had to just trust who I was, as a person and not necessarily listen to everyone.
Okay. We've talked about this. And I want to know if this is, does a reporter show up more real? Does a good reporter show up more real than they are? I had a donor once tell me that I wasn't crisp, for example. And if for a minute I flinched there and I was angry, and then I went back and I think in the conversation, I said, look, man, I said, I want to be more real than crisp.
Yeah.
Does a reporter show up more real than they are crisp?
What's that? As a reporter for me, I don't think I came across as real. And I look at old tapes now and I'm just like, oh, Why are you changing your voice? Why are you doing this with yourself? Why are you trying to act a certain way? It's clearly, this guy isn't comfortable with himself. That's what I look back at. So those are cool lessons to kind of see. But at the same time, just being a person, I still had those strong, you know, gifts, I guess, those superpowers, the gift of gab, passion, and energy. But just like I compared to the X-Men, I didn't know how to control my superpowers. I had to learn. I had to learn hard lessons. And that's why I like to compare, you know, my LinkedIn posts I did about the X-Men and fundraising and young fundraisers. They're so excited. They're so cool. And they're ready to go, but they just don't have their wings yet. They haven't learned to control their powers. And that was Sam. And there's so many of them out there, and I want to help them.
And isn't it true that those superpowers, you can't develop them in the classroom and you can't really develop them behind your desk? Those superpowers, you know, those supermen and men and women, mm-hmm. they have to get out into the field. And I think that's one of I think is one of the deficits in the way that we train up development officers today is sure. that we train them in the classroom. We train them in the classroom and we teach them to use all these extensions, but we don't teach them how to be in the field. And it's only late in their career when they realize that most of the meaningful work that they could derive the most satisfaction from comes from sitting across the lunch table and having lunch with that donor or sitting at that ball game with your donor.
Boom. And who's your Professor X, right? Jason, you're the Professor X to so many other X-Men out there, right? That's what you are for us. You know, that's what I like to look at it. You know, I'm a dork. I love philanthropy. Yeah. I like to bring in my humor now and then because I do think I'm funny. I do. But that's how I look at it, you know, and everyone needs a Professor X. You know, Jim Langley was mine. You know, that man came to Chicago a couple years ago for a meeting with a big university and literally took 30 minutes out of his time or an hour to have coffee with. Literally. I reached out to him on LinkedIn, just hoping for the best. I was in a tough part of my career. I needed some guidance and he was there for me. And you can bet when I get out of this funk of not having a job, I'm going to pay it forward 110%. Even if I don't find a job, that's what it's all about for me.
Okay. But you know, okay, that's brilliant. You know, Sam, he had that 30-minute conversation. In my mind, he had that. I know Jim very well. We live within an hour apart. We've gotten together a number of times and enjoyed meals together and so forth. He very, very graciously read my first book and was very complimentary and gave me some good feedback. Jim has become a good friend. But you know as well, I think you know, he had that 30-minute meeting because he's a really talented fundraiser. That's what he was doing. He knows how to have that. He knows how to show up. Yeah. And he also knows how to take chances. He didn't know who you were and he didn't know where he wasn't looking for a predictable outcome. Sure. He just said, I can chance 30 minutes to have a cup of coffee with this guy.
And it meant the world to me, man.
Mm-hmm. Of course it did. And we're talking about it years later. I mean, isn't that what.
That's what it's about.
That's what it's about. I mean, that's one of the things I'm working on. I'm spending a lot of time sort of understanding the context in which our world with this hyperconnection, you know, we can sort of be all over the world and, you know, with Zoom and all these things. But what it means is we have to be really great explorers. Do you think you're an explorer?
Yes, I love to explore. I mean, that's my curiosity and that's why I was a reporter. I wanted to find out what was going on out there. Yeah. Sociology was also, you know, I was a journalism major, but sociology was pretty fascinating to me because it got to teach me how to approach different people, different backgrounds, different, you know, races and whatever, wealth, you know, all that. It taught me so much about just humans in general. And Jim made me feel like I was normal. Like I really felt like I looked at philanthropy like I thought I was special and cool and different and authentic and real. And little did I know that there was Jason Lewis and Jim Langley and all these other cool guys and girls, Teresa Lee, that get philanthropy. And it's literally like finding your tribe. And I don't have a job right now. Yes, I don't have everything I want right now, but I'd rather have all of you guys on my side knowing that I'm going to get that job. And trust me, I'm going to change this industry and make it better. You know, that's what I'm doing. And it's because of your mentors. And it's because of people that just take a chance.
Show your heart. Okay. So show your heart a little bit before we let you go. Is it wearing on you that you don't have a job? Is it wearing on you that you don't have a job right now?
It did for a long time because mine didn't end because of COVID. Mine, you know, it was a change of
elimination January, of a job. Right.
Yeah, right before it was right before Christmas. It was 2 days before Christmas. I didn't know anything was happening. I closed a $10,000 gift, and the next day I was out. And that was hurtful. But you know, it is what it is. So, does it hurt? Not anymore. Now it's just made it's fueled me. This whole situation. Losing my friend and my coworker, the person I was managing at my last job, die of COVID. That changed me. So I don't know what the future holds, but I mean, I think it's just a lot going on. It's I'm happier now than I ever was. And I don't have the 6-figure salary. I don't have the title, but I have my peace of mind back. And now I'm ready to get back into the workspace. Sometimes you need to take the time. Especially right now, there's a lot of fundraisers that have just lost their jobs. They're panicking. They're nervous. They're scared. I get it. I've been there. I'm still there. But there is that other. But you got to take the time to process it all. It wasn't your fault. It wasn't you. And now it's time. But event. Have those moments of frustration. People will tell you that, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, I don't want to hear that right now. Let you have that week or a couple of days. And then you got to get back on your feet. You know what I'm saying? You got to let people grieve. You know, let them have their moment. And as long as they can get back on track, that's the most important thing as a fundraiser.
I have relished this conversation. I've interrupted you as much as you've had to share. So I appreciate you affording me some of the platform. I hope that we've afforded you somewhat of a platform. If somebody's listening today and they want to reach out to you and they want to say, hey, Sam, we'll talk to you about this role we've got to fill here at our organization, how would you like them to do that?
Sure. They could reach me at my sam.proven@gmail.com. I also am on my LinkedIn. I love sharing posts and tips and strategies, and I love for your feedback as well. So that's a great way to get a hold of me.
All right, Sam. So we will, if you will, Sam, send me a PDF of your resume, I will attach it to the show notes as well. So we'll make this process real, real swift and easy. So if anybody's interested in talking to Sam and they want to kind of check him out a little bit ahead of time, you just go to the show notes and you can find his resume and then reach out to Sam. And Sam, I have enjoyed this conversation. Will you come back after you figure things out, after you land that great job and you're playing at a good ballpark? Will you come back and tell me how things are going?
Oh my gosh, I can't wait. I'm putting that out there right now.
Okay. All right, bud. Good talking to you.
Thank you so much, my friend.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.